Good morning to everyone. We are down to one oral argument this morning, and it is State v. Nia Lee, 19 AP 221 CR. Could I have the appearances, please? We have one person appearing by phone, so we'll start with you.
May it please the court, my name is Attorney Julian Lennon, and I represent Nia Lee.
Great. All right, and then as I understand it, you have 15 minutes. You will be arguing. I will try to give you a heads up when 5 minutes is left in your argument in case you feel like you need to move forward to discuss something else.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, and then counsel. Thank you. Great. All right. So the lineup is 15 minutes by Attorney Lennon, followed by 5 minutes by Attorney Huffman, 5 minutes by Attorney Hennick, 30 minutes by Attorney Barber, and then we return for rebuttal with Attorney Lennon. Right? Okay. All right. We also have Lancaster High School here this morning. Could you please stand if you're from the high school? Great. It's nice to see you here. We hope that you enjoy oral argument this morning and return safely to beautiful Grant County before any sort of weather hits this area. But Justice Kurofsky will be briefly after oral arguments this morning to answer questions about the court system or talk to you about any questions you have. I always say, you know, try to think of some really good ones to ask her because she's really smart and she likes being challenged in that regard. So you're going to have a few minutes to do that. But here to help. And anyway, so welcome. It's nice to see you here today. Go ahead and have a seat. And with that, we'll start up with argument this morning. 15 minutes, starting with Attorney Lennon. Please proceed.
May it please the court, Your Honor, my name is Attorney Julian Lennon and I represent Nia Lee. This case is about my client waiting in custody for 101 days without the appointment of a lawyer or the holding of a preliminary hearing. There is no dispute between the parties that the Court of Appeals correctly held that the Circuit Court erroneously exercised its discretion and that the remedy for that failure is dismissal of the case. The sole issue here is whether the resulting dismissal is without prejudice or with prejudice. There are two prongs to the argument that the dismissal should be with prejudice. The first is that the length of the delay in conducting the preliminary hearing in this case is so extreme that dismissal should be with prejudice. I acknowledge that the case law is against this position. The second prong is that the dismissal should be with prejudice because the situation resulted and a total denial of the right to counsel for more than 3 months. This is not an ineffective assistance of counsel case. It is a systemic denial of counsel, and under chronic, such a denial is presumed prejudicial because Lee did not have the actual assistance of counsel for 101 days. He was denied his right to counsel. Therefore, the constitutional guarantee of counsel was violated under United States versus Chronic, 466 U.S. 648 at 654 and footnote 25.
So, Attorney Lennon, this is Chief Justice Ziegler asking you a question. What's the right number?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, the right number for what?
How many days is the right number of days? Are you asking the court to say, you know, after X amount of days, this right is invoked, or what exactly? What's the test, or when do we know?
Well, Your Honor, my understanding is that the right to counsel attaches at the initial appearance, and what the state is arguing is that you only have a right to counsel at critical stages. So there's no harm in delaying the preliminary hearing. What I'm arguing, Your Honor, is that under chronic, that 3 months is the absence of counsel. That is too long. I can't give you a specific number, preferably prior to the preliminary hearing. If the court has information that the public defender's office is close to getting an attorney or that they have somebody who's interested but they need to reschedule, then that may be a good basis to extend it for an additional 10 days.
So I guess my question really is, what's the rule? What is the rule that you want us to put forward in this case? What is the holding or the rule?
Well, the rule that I would like is that this case should be dismissed with prejudice because it is a three-month delay in the holding of the preliminary hearing is too long, and that 3-month delay is an absolute denial of the right to counsel. That is the ruling that I am asking this court to order.
So this is Justice Dallet. Just following up on that, the right to a counsel attached at the initial appearance, but isn't the right to counsel, if you're looking at that framework and not speedy trial framework, doesn't the right to counsel mean counsel at critical stages, and there wasn't really a critical stage happening yet, right? The initial appearance is one, the preliminary hearing is one, at least from a framework perspective. What's the critical stage at that point? If you want to say, go ahead.
I'm sorry, did not mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
I don't concede that Mr. Lee had counsel at the initial appearance, which is a critical stage, because what he had was limited scope representation by a public defender's office staff attorney who was conducting intake at that point in time. That attorney was not signed to his case. She didn't do any work on his case other than do the initial appearance. The next critical stage is the preliminary hearing. However, under Chronic, it is the absence of counsel. When you have an absence of counsel for 3 months, that is presumed prejudicial, and the defendant does not have to prove prejudice.
But following up on that, if we were to hold that every person staffing intake was not really counsel, we would have a big problem, wouldn't we? I mean, it was counsel at the initial appearance. Otherwise, doesn't that open up a whole nother thing, that's not really counsel if it's not someone who, I don't know. I don't know how we would define that.
Well, Your Honor, even the Public Defender's Office in their brief to the court acknowledges that is limited scope representation. The intake attorney for the Public Defender's Office is a staff attorney who meets with the clients at the jail, obtains their financial evaluation, determines if they're eligible, usually gets the complaint just prior to the initial appearance, does the initial appearance, ask for bond, and then ask for the preliminary hearing. That's all they do. They don't do any additional work on the client's case other than appearing at that initial appearance.
Except counsel, I mean, that's really important. At least that's been my experience. That's a really important point of representation, and my experience with the Public Defender's Office has been that they do a really good job of representing their clients and arguing for bond, and it's important to have them there. It's almost like you're arguing that it's important but not really important. They're only there to do very trivial things. That then would diminish the whole right to have a lawyer with you at initial appearance. Be careful about going down that road.
Your Honor, I'm not in any way attempting to diminish the role of the Public Defender's Office intake attorney at the initial appearance and the bond hearing. What I'm attempting to establish is that the period between the initial appearance and the preliminary hearing is a period of 101 days. And for that 101 days, my client did not have an attorney assigned to his case. That attorney did not actively work on his case. She did not meet with him to interview him about the facts of his case. She did not discuss any potential defenses or witnesses or evidence to be located. She was not working specifically on his case. That is what I mean, Your Honor.
Attorney Lennon, this is Justice Kurofsky. I have a question regarding the custody status of your client, and that is, it's my understanding that Mr. Lee was in custody on a supervision hold out of the Department of Corrections for the entire 101 days. How does that, do you think, how should that impact our decision in this case?
Your Honor, I don't think he, it is correct that he was on extended supervision hold. I don't believe that that is part of the analysis, because the issue is that he still is entitled to have counsel, and he still is entitled to have a preliminary hearing on within the time limits. My position is the legislature set those time limits for a reason. The primary purpose of the preliminary hearing is to prevent hasty and improvident prosecution and to discover whether there is a substantial basis for bringing the prosecution and further denying the accused his right to liberty.
Let me just ask a follow-up question, if I might, then, because one of the other issues that you've argued is a speedy trial issue. Are you just today arguing the Sixth Amendment right to counsel claim?
No, Your Honor. It is my position was that the legislature, when you look at the legislative history, the legislature specifically said in the judicial commentary note that it was attempting to protect the individual's right to a speedy trial. And that was one of the reasons they set forth those time limits, including the time limit for conducting a preliminary hearing, for filing the information, for having the arraignment. My client's rights are not triggered until he has the preliminary hearing. He doesn't have the ability to obtain discovery. He can't have motions. He can't move his case forward until after he has the preliminary hearing. So when the preliminary hearing is delayed, his case is essentially stalled.
So if I could just ask a hypothetical question then. In this case, because of the charges that were filed against your client, there was no victim, but what if you had, say, a serious sexual assault case, a first or second degree sexual assault case, and there was a victim who also had rights? You would be asking us to dismiss the case with prejudice so it could never be charged out, and then the victim wouldn't have justice. How would we, in that hypothetical, how would we balance all of those rights?
5 minutes, counsel.
Thank you. Well, Your Honor, that's a good point, and I acknowledge that there are victims' rights under the Constitution. However, it does harm to the victim to have the proceedings delayed for such an extensive period of time also. I would point out that 101 days without having any resolution of the case, under the current statutory scheme, he could have had an entire speedy trial prior to that, even having the preliminary hearing in this case. I did want to point out that Lee does not have to prove prejudice because counsel was absent for 101 days, I apologize, under chronic footnote 25. I also wanted to state that this was a systematic and structural breakdown in the appointment of counsel for indigent defendants, which resulted in the inability to appoint counsel. Lee does not need to establish the time period between the initial appearance and the preliminary hearing was a critical stage. Under chronic, in the absence of counsel, prejudice is presumed. Counsel was absent for more than 3 months. Therefore, prejudice is presumed.
So I'm going to ask one more question. Sorry if I'm hogging the questions. But I don't see any of my colleagues looking to ask a question. Let me ask you one more, Ms. Lennon. Sometimes we sort of rank order what might be remedies in cases. And I'm hearing you say that your platinum or what you would like the most is for us to dismiss the case with prejudice. If we were not going to do that, if we didn't do that, do you have a next best resolution?
Well, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals has already indicated that the case should be dismissed without prejudice. I mean, so my remedy is dismissal with prejudice. And the reason I'm asking for that is primarily because of those two reasons, the violation of the right to counsel for over 101 days and the exceedingly long delay in conducting the preliminary hearing. Given the purpose of the preliminary hearing and the legislative intent, it is my position that a delay of over 3 months in conducting the preliminary hearing is too long. Lee's preliminary hearing was supposed to be held by September 21st of 2018. It was extended and delayed until January 2nd of 2019. That is a long delay. That is too long of a delay. I don't know where I'm at as far as time. I'm sorry.
1 minute 40 seconds.
I would also just like to point out that while there has been some argument about the cost to the counties, I would point out that there is a cost at the rate of $21 a day. The fee for keeping Mr. Lee in custody while they waited to look for an attorney was over $2,000. That cost is also borne by the county.
Counsel, but Mr. Lee would have been in custody anyway, because he was on a hold for violation of his obligation to register as a sex offender. So I don't think we can balance that in this particular case.
All right, Your Honor. And the other thing I would like to point out is that it is my position that I did not waive my right to raise constitutional arguments. As the Court of Appeals had indicated that it use the doctrine of constitutional avoidance to avoid deciding this issue, and specifically that I failed to demonstrate that the period between the initial appearance and the preliminary hearing was a critical stage. The Court of Appeals was wrong on the law because Lee's case was a result of a structural breakdown resulting in the systematic failure to appoint counsel. The Court has uniformly found constitutional error without any showing of prejudice when counsel was totally absent. In Lee's case, counsel was totally absent. And that is on chronic footnote 25. I would also like to add that I did not decline to make a record. The court asked if I wanted an evidentiary hearing at the March 25th, 2019 hearing. I said I was willing to subpoena Detective Lisa Rennie. The court then stated that it was more in the nature of a suppression motion for failure to provide attorney and that Lee had independent remedies, and that is on the transcript, page 11 and 12. Therefore, the court withdrew its offer of an evidentiary hearing.
Counsel, your time is up. Did you conclude your thought in that
regard? Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I apologize for going over.
No, you're perfectly fine, and you've done a nice job appearing by telephone. That has its own challenges, but well done.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Attorney Hoffman. Now, you're appearing pro hoc vice?
Yes, Your Honor.
Were you previously admitted?
To this court by an order from this court, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. I'm just trying to dot the I's, cross the T's, and make sure that someone doesn't object to your argument later.
I certainly appreciate that. I value my license as well.
Okay.
My name is Bonnie Hoffman. I'm here on behalf of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. And we ask that this court today find that the Sixth Amendment is violated when an eligible defendant is not timely provided counsel. The Sixth Amendment promises to an accused the right to have a counsel for defense that's not simply having a lawyer present for a critical stage event like a trial or a preliminary hearing. It is the right to have the guiding hand of counsel throughout the proceedings. Now, the right to counsel attaches at that initial appearance when the state and when the accused are set into those adversary roles. And there is no question that there is a right to counsel at every critical stage that happens after, whether that happens in a courtroom like a probable cause hearing, or it happens in a plea negotiation or a live lineup outside of the court process.
But he had a lawyer for the probable cause hearing, which occurred at
Well, he had 2 days of initial appearances because he was not truthful about his name. So it started on one day and then finally on the second day. But there was a probable cause determination, correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And a lawyer was present with him.
And he had counsel present at that critical stage. And the question really for this court is that gap in between, that time between attachment when he had that initial counsel, and certainly I think there's agreement from the State Public Defender's Office that there was no counsel that continued from that initial appearance. And the period we're talking about is a period between attachment of the right and that critical stage event, and when is it constitutionally appropriate and necessary for counsel to be present. And there are really 2 ways to look at this. You can either use the method that the Supreme Court used in Powell versus Alabama, in which the court looked and said, how soon before a critical stage event, in that case a trial, must counsel be present and actively engaged? And the court there said the counsel has to be there in sufficient time to aid in preparation, to conduct a thorough and a prompt investigation. We can look in the reverse way, which is what the court in Rothgary did, which asked how soon after an attachment, an initial appearance, must counsel be present? And the court said it has to be a reasonable time after to allow the attorney to aid in preparation. That's the time period we're talking about here, that gap in which counsel can be active and engage in necessary steps.
A similar question to the one I asked of Attorney Lennon. How do we know? I don't disagree with you, okay? But how do you define that, and when does it reach the point of prejudice versus without prejudice?
Absolutely.
I mean, the best case is to have a lawyer from the very beginning. I don't quarrel with that thought. Having said that, it often doesn't happen. So how do we define that so that we know when the time comes that it has been so violative that it requires prejudice?
Justice Ziegler, certainly you are correct. The best practice is to have that attorney at the initial appearance and for that attorney to continue to do all those meaningful hallmarks of representation going forward. But when we talk about what that magic number should be, that number should be talked about in a matter of days, certainly no more than weeks, and definitely not months. Because while that attorney is not there, we can put the procedural process on hold, but that doesn't put on hold all the other things that are occurring, the witnesses that are not interviewed or located.
Here's the problem with that analysis. Having been at the trial level, in some counties, they're very quick to appoint lawyers and get them on the cases. In other counties, not so quick, for a variety of reasons, but judges have the authority to do it. They have the authority and have had the authority to appoint lawyers, and there are a variety of practices out there. So if we set a period of time, 10 days, 30 days, 25 days, that can impact a variety of practices out there, and it's sort of an unusual thing for this court to do in terms of a case. So talk to me about that, because it almost sounds like you're trying to have us do rulemaking by case law.
Justice, I believe that the first part of this question is what should be done in an individual case. And in an individual case such as this, dismissal without prejudice is the appropriate remedy for 2 reasons. First, we cannot go back and repair the harm that's been done. We can't go back and recreate the things that didn't happen. But second is, if we don't impose a remedy like dismissal with prejudice, then we don't deter this action from continuing. This problem in this state is part of a systematic issue.
I know,
for 10 years.
Not just perpetrators of crimes.
Absolutely.
Here, we're not worried about that issue, but our decision will affect many cases where there are victims of violent crimes. So you're asking us, if a lawyer isn't appointed within a number of days or at least a couple of weeks, that we should dismiss it with prejudice. So where's the rights for the victim in that? They're constitutional in Wisconsin.
You can go ahead and answer that question. 5 minutes
you.
Goes awfully fast.
It does. It does. And, you know, the fact that the victim has constitutional rights doesn't and should never derogate the constitutional rights of the defendant. This court for a decade has been warning about this constitutional crisis. Public defense resources are limited, and states may have to and localities may have to make difficult choices about what cases they prosecute and don't in order to ensure that those resources are adequately provided in a constitutional way.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Kath.
May May it please the court, my name is Ellen Hennick, and I represent the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys. As you know, we've given some thought to this problem for a long time. This is not a new problem. And I think one of the concerns that I have here, not so much in discretionary, whether we dismiss without prejudice for the discretionary reasons, whether the court met its discretionary obligations. I think that's kind of a floor here at this point. Our concern is that two things. One, if you think about representation as a matter of dot to dot, as long as at each dot there is a living, breathing body, we've met that obligation. We've harmed not only the defendants, but also the victims, because the victim's right, ultimately, is to have the perpetrator convicted, not to have just someone convicted in order to feel good. And to the extent that what we have here is a problem with evidence disappearing, we can't be sure in some of these cases whether we've got the right person at all. Now, in this case, that may or may not be an issue. But to just simply waive the idea that victims have a right to have somebody convicted, that's not what their right is at all. Their right is to have the person who did it to them convicted. And there's a difference. And the only way you don't see that difference is if you assume every defendant is guilty. And that's not what our law has ever done. Now, as to timing, I think that if you look at what the legislature was trying to do with preliminary hearing, it gives you some guidance. Because they've always been fairly tight on time in preliminary hearings, and that's changed a little bit. But the ideas they were having is, oh, okay, we put this off because an attorney was ill. We put this off because the court failed to produce the defendant. They never thought, and when you look at the speedy trial that kind of runs from after this, because it runs from the indictment, it never occurred to them that we would be sitting for months and months. And so I think the timing of when is a really difficult problem. Is it before the preliminary hearing? Obviously not. Is it maybe one adjournment of the preliminary hearing? Not if there's some reason to believe something's going to change. But when you get to the point where evidence starts disappearing, or where you believe it will, because you've also got a practical problem, how does that defendant know evidence will disappear? In this case, there's some suggestion, not completely proven, that there's a cell phone that matters. Now, the catch is, if Lee's attorney were able to prove that the cell phone matters, he's also proving that there's no harm, because if you can establish it matters, I mean, so we've got an unknown here. It's a problem.
Counsel, I think one of the things the court is struggling with is the effect our opinion will have, not just for this person, obviously, but for the rest of the state. In your brief, you really don't give, of course, and I think you can say there is no magic number. It all depends on the circumstances. I think you said that on page 6.
Right.
Yeah. And you give a list, I'll say laundry list, but with great respect.
It is a laundry list.
You give a list of considerations, and all of those are important. All of those should guide a decision. But I think if there's something that drives us that says, okay, 90 days here, is that reasonable under the circumstances? And it's always under the circumstances, isn't it? Or can we say, as a matter of law, 90 days is unreasonable?
I think there's one way to do that. The way to do that is to take the guidance from the legislature with regard to speedy trial. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that the remedy for speedy trial isn't dismissal with prejudice. But I think you can take that and say, look, and that does not run, by the way, from initial appearance. That runs from indictment, but you can kind of time out when that likely would be. And if you time that out, you go, okay, the preliminary hearing, if it's held correctly, should be held within 10 days, so we get to that. And then we add on, let's assume that the arraignment's within a couple, you know, that day or the next day, and then we start the 90-day process from there. That would be one way to link it to what the legislature has kind of been thinking about.
But in that example, that gets you, if my math is right, to 101 days, which is what we had here.
And it may very well. I am bothered by this length, but I think if you're going to put a number on it, that would be one way to do it. Am I happy with that result? No, but the question was, if you're trying to link it to something, what does it naturally link to? And I think that may be one way to approach it. I still have concerns, and it may be that you link it to that for automatically, but if I could establish that evidence that's key has disappeared, it may be that it's shorter than that. It may be that a way to do this is to make it presumptive. It's presumptively prejudicial at 90 days, which again sort of links to the speedy trial.
5 minutes goes awfully fast.
Oh, I see that. Yes. I'm sorry. Do you want me to finish that thought? Or
finish your thought.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I've forgotten the thought. We're at that
point. 90 days, unless evidence is missing.
You could use it as, you could use it presumptively and maybe allow, if you can establish there's been something in particular that has happened before. Thank you very much. And I apologize for going over. I just
no
didn't
worries.
See it.
None. Very interesting.
Attorney Barber.
Thank you. There are two separate narrow issues before this court. The first is the jurisdictional question. Did the delay in the preliminary hearing extinguish the state's ability to continue to prosecute Mr. Lee? And as defense counsel has indicated, there is, and as the Court of Appeals recognized, there's 50 years of case law that says no. Answers that flat out. The remedy is a dismissal without prejudice. There is constitutional claims which are entirely separate from that. And the state wants to, in its argument here, make sure we're consistent on which we're focused on. In that respect, the state completely disagrees with the statement from defense counsel that there was a total denial of the right to counsel here. That is just not true. Lee had counsel at his initial appearance. His initial appearance on September 10th was, in fact, put off by a day so that the public defender assigned to him could meet with him. The public defender argued bond, and the matter was put over. There is nothing, and let me back up there, under Wisconsin case law, Koch, and under federal case law, Gillespie, there is no constitutional right to counsel at an initial appearance. Period. The fact that he had counsel is great, and the state's not, you know, suggesting that the public defender should stop doing that, but the fact he did not have permanent counsel appointed there does not affect the jurisdiction of the court. And the defendant has not, even if the court wants to go down that road, the defendant hasn't identified anything that assigned counsel failed to do.
Counsel, what's troubling about the way, thinking about it in terms of just having counsel at these points, which would be preliminary hearing, he's required to have counsel, but not having it in between, potentially, the initial appearance, is that this was like a moving target. Yes, he's got a right to counsel at preliminary hearing, but all the preliminary hearing just kept moving and moving and moving, so it's concerning that that right to counsel just kept getting pushed and pushed and pushed. You can certainly conceive of a case where evidence is absolutely disappearing, where witnesses are gone, where that whole initial time period is lost to a defendant in terms of preparation.
No, I mean, and the state certainly wants cases to be timely prosecuted, but I want to be clear here that these delays, number one, they weren't asked for by the state. Number two, they were for Mr. Lee's benefit to ensure he had counsel at the critical stage, at the preliminary hearing.
I missed your number one. Can you just speak a beat slower? You made 2 points, and I missed your number. I just missed your number one. I want to make sure I hear it. Oh, sorry. That happens to me all the time.
I can't remember what I said, unfortunately.
You just said the delays weren't asked for by the state.
The delays were not requested by the state.
Thank you.
And second, they were for Mr. Lee's benefit to make sure he had counsel at the preliminary hearing. And there's no dispute that the way existing case law is structured under Rothkary, it's the critical stages analysis. And a critical stage is one where the state is, in essence, being an adversary, presenting evidence against the defendant. So there's no dispute that the preliminary hearing is a critical stage, but there is absolutely zero authority to conclude that there was a critical stage in the gap in between there.
So could they just push off the preliminary hearing? I mean, could it have been another 30 days, another 60 days, another 90 days? I mean, at what point are you gonna agree that there's maybe a systemic problem, that it is attributable to the state? I mean, or can the state just continually put off the preliminary hearing?
The state cannot continue, and the court cannot continually put off the hearing here. And that portion of the Court of Appeals decision, the state is not challenging. So for purposes of here, it's undisputed the court erroneously exercised its discretion in putting that off based upon the record it made. Now, the state thinks that the court could have made a record that would have justified it here, but the court doesn't really have the issue of whether there was good cause and when there is good cause isn't really here. The question is, what is the remedy because there wasn't good cause?
Okay, now I'm concerned about the fact that you think that there was good cause along the way. Please address that, because that is something that this court could be concerned about given the length of this delay.
I'm not arguing that there was good cause. My point was that there could have been a finding of good cause had the court made the appropriate record as set forth in the Court of Appeals opinion. The problem the Court of Appeals had was that these push-offs were almost automatic. They would call Mr. Lee on the jail phone, and it would be, you have counsel, no, okay, pushed off.
So failure to appoint counsel over and over again would be a the court could have found good cause had they said, we tried 50 attorneys, we tried 60 attorneys, we tried 90 attorneys.
It's a case-by-case basis. And if there was a factual record made as to the reason for these continual delays and something more than just you don't have counsel appointed, and that option is left open in the Court of Appeals decision. So, but the question here isn't whether there was good cause, because, again, for purposes of this appeal, the state has conceded that the Court of Appeals decision was correct in that regard. So the question is, what is the remedy for that? And again, we have 50 years of case law that existed before the statute on the preliminary hearing was enacted and cases after that. And importantly, Lee has not asked this court to overrule those cases. To the extent that, to try and answer the court's question about remedy, and the state really did not get into this in its briefing because there is no dispute that he had counsel appointed at all critical stages. But if the court is going to look at a denial of counsel sort of remedy thing, then Okransky versus State 51 Wis TD 210. That's a 1971 case. And that holds that the failure to appoint counsel is subject to a harmless error analysis after the fact, after the trial has occurred, so that there can be evidence presented. Was the defendant prevented from being heard on all motions? Was there evidence lost? And that's the same after-the-fact analysis that the case law says we have to use for the speedy trial analysis. And that comes from Erdahl, which incorporated the four-factor Barker analysis, and also from LeMay, which says you cannot have a finding of a speedy trial violation before the trial has actually occurred.
Counsel, it is my recollection that one of the considerations set forth in the Court of Appeals decision was cost to the counties. I hope my recollection is correct. But I know that it is contested that cost to the county, the monetary cost of appointing counsel at county expense is not an appropriate consideration because they should not be allowed to trump a defendant's constitutional rights. Weigh in on that for me, if you will.
The state is not going to weigh in on that.
There are angels fear to tread. It's not that you're an angel. I guess maybe
that's not an issue here, and the state is not going to address that.
Okay.
From the state's perspective, I think if you're going to go into that and look at the cost thing, the state's concern is there seems to be this impression, and maybe in some cases it's true, that the counties can just automatically appoint counsel. And I mean, there's no record here that it could, and maybe in a simple possession case it could. But if you're looking at, let's say, a rural county and you've got a complex sexual assault case, there might not be someone who's readily available who can be appointed on the 10th day or whatever arbitrary date Mr. Lee is arguing for now. So, I mean, to the extent costs affect that, I mean, the state's concern with that is more whether there's someone actually available. But I, the state is not going to weigh in on whether that's an appropriate factor for the exercise of discretion here.
Thank you.
So to reiterate, we have 50 years of case law saying that the failure to timely hold a preliminary hearing is not a jurisdictional defect. The remedy is a dismissal without prejudice, allowing the state to recharge. And that makes sense specifically when it's considered in light of what are the remedies for other constitutional violations along this path. We know that in the context of a Riverside hearing, that the case law says if there is a denial of a Riverside hearing, that does not result in dismissal. The remedy there is potentially suppression of evidence that was obtained when counsel should have been appointed. So we know there's not a jurisdictional issue there. We even know that for the purposes of statutory speedy trial under 971.10.4, if the speedy trial cannot be honored, then the remedy is that the defendant is released from custody. It's not that the action is dismissed. And that would really be a radical proposition if this court were to conclude that the fact that counsel cannot be appointed within an arbitrary time means the state loses the ability to prosecute and the victims lose the ability to get justice. That just cannot be the law. Addressing the various constitutional claims that were brought up, I've already, I think, addressed the right to counsel, that Lee has had counsel at all critical stages. In terms of speedy trial, again, it's premature to make that determination. And, you know, the prejudice analysis, I think, is relevant both to the speedy trial claims and the due process claims. And first of all, I disagree with the way counsel is reading the transcript from the arraignment. Let me grab it here. Where these allegations of there being, a cell phone or something, the court says that's not part of the record. And defense counsel says, I don't know how to establish those. I only know my client's what's representing to me, and I'm not really wanting him to testify. And that's fair enough. That's an understandable decision. But the fact is, there is no evidentiary record of prejudice in this case. So in that fact alone, these constitutional claims fail. Also, in terms of the due process violation of due process allegation here, the fact that Mr. Lee was in custody is very pertinent to that question. Because, first of all, he suffered no extended pretrial detainment that he otherwise would not have been subject to. Second of all, he did have a Riverside hearing. He had a prompt 48-hour probable cause determination. That is the constitutional standard that must be met before the state can detain someone for further criminal proceedings. So that was met here. He had regular review hearings. He had a bail review hearing, again, at which counsel was present. So there is no denial of due process here. There was probable cause found multiple times, and he otherwise would have been incarcerated.
Mr. Barber, this you might not know the answer to this question, but one of the things that is perplexing to me about this case is why cash? I don't understand why the state didn't just go in and say, you know, Commissioner, please amend this to a signature bond. You think we would still be here? I mean, maybe it doesn't matter. I just got to tell you, it's a head scratcher for me when I look at these charges and I look at the. I understand that there's still a 20-day deadline for a prelim, even if you're out of custody, but I don't understand.
I don't know the answer to that, and I mean that might be, you know, pertinent in a case where the defendant is not otherwise in custody. I don't know if that was the reason, the fact that he was on the hold, which ultimately was revoked. But
it could be as simple as they wanted to have credit for both cases, and you don't get credit if you have a signature bond in one and you're still sitting in jail on the other.
Right.
That's pretty common, that defense counsel actually doesn't want a signature bond because they want credit. So that's not unreasonable.
Yeah.
So I think in these broader issues of, you know, right to counsel, speedy trial, again, they're most appropriately determined after the process has finished and there can be a record made and a determination of whether there was, in fact, prejudice. On the record now, they're not proven. And in terms of, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the problem in the air. And it's not necessary for the court to address that. There was no requirement that the county court appoint counsel at county expense. Certainly it could have, but there's no binding authority that required it to do so. And to the extent this court wants to get into how to deal with the issue of shortage of public defenders in some counties, again, as the state set forth in its brief, that really is a matter for a rules petition because it really is creating law. Certainly the court has the authority to do it, but that affects so many different variables. It affects the cost of the counties. It affects the mission of the SPD, and that whole statutory scheme. So, I mean, if the court wants to go down that route, the state would urge the court to use its rulemaking powers to do that. And I would refer back to I can't remember if it was Learned Hand, but the old saying that, you know, when you legislate, you can use a surgeon's scalpel, but when you adjudicate a case, it's a meat cleaver. And I don't think this case is the appropriate vehicle to start using a meat cleaver because it's going to affect every criminal case in the state, and it's going to affect crime victims, and there's going to be so many different factual permutations of this that it's not something that's amenable to just announcing a rule of judicial administration in a case. And that actually is really all I have, unless there are other questions, which I am happy to answer.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Attorney Lennon, 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I would like to just address one or two things. First of all, in regard to although we are not challenging this, in regard to the Court of Appeals decision and the four-cause extension, I just want to point out that when you review the transcripts, it was a matter of routine. We're extending the preliminary hearing time limits for cause. That was the analysis. The Public Defender's Office has developed a form which tells the court what their efforts have been. We've talked to 200 attorneys, 1,200 attorneys. They have developed that in response to Selders. The problem is that still doesn't address the issue of how long of a delay is prejudicial to the client. Given that we live in a technology-oriented society, where there is surveillance video everywhere. I just want to point out that surveillance video is routinely cycled over so that it is permanently destroyed within a matter of days or 2 weeks at most in most cases. The other thing I would like to state is that rulemaking is not appropriate because the issue is the violation of this particular defendant's rights and what his remedy is. We do not decide that question via rulemaking. If after this issue is resolved, the state wishes to propose a general rule for handling the underlying problems, the state is free to do so. In Mr. Lee's case, both the criminal complaint and the preliminary hearing record established that he said to the officer, my family was threatened. There is a potential defense for Mr. Lee that has been denied by the inability of counsel to obtain items as critical to his defense. It is my position that under Cronic, he was absolutely denied the right to the effective assistance of counsel. Prejudice is presumed that if we go with just a critical stage analysis, it undermines the decision in Cronic and is not faithful to that. The footnote specifically lists a line of cases that say absence of counsel is presumed prejudice, and that is what occurred here. You cannot say that 101 days without an attorney is anything less than the absolute denial of counsel and the absence of counsel. There was no one there working on Mr. Lee's case for 101 days. I have nothing further. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. The oral arguments in this case are concluded. Thank you for making the trip here, and thank you for your presentations, both in written and oral form. The court will meet in
11 o'clock.
Okay, 11 o'clock. And in the meantime, Justice Kurowski's awaiting your pressing questions, so make them good.